So I just figured out why Jessica decided on my story as opposed to so many others, because I promised that I would warn the audience that I would have an emotional release at least twice during the story. So if I do, don't rush the stage and give me a hug. I'm okay. Everything's fine, okay? So I'm going to introduce four characters in my story. The first character is our Nadia, our Haitian translator, who's been our translator for probably 20 years, and you learn to trust your translator with your life sometimes. Well, this is 2010, and Nadia is 7.5 months pregnant. She has a tumor the size of a cantaloupe on her uterus, and even delivering on a good day in Port-au-Prince probably wouldn't be a good idea. So the second person in my story is my clipboard. And what I found out is that he who has the clipboard or the walkie-talkie must know something, so ask him or her, all right? So this clipboard has been with me through most of my disaster work. The second person in our story is International Medical Alliance, which is a small NGO, and we work on in the Batays in the Dominican Republic. The Batays are basically slave camps the Dominicans run, and they have the poorest of the poor Haitians, if you can imagine the poorest of the poor Haitians, and they cut the sugar cane for the Dominicans. And so we try and provide them with health care and dentistry and women's health. And so I never have quite a really cozy feeling when I see the Baltimore Domino Sugar downtown. It doesn't do the same thing for me as it might be for you. The fourth character in our story is the Haitian people, and they're just a lovely people. They're just best people I've ever worked with. I've been working there with their dental school and various projects over the years, and they're just great people. Every night in our pop-up hospital, which ended up being one of the largest hospitals, doing the most surgeries after the earthquake, and what we found out was that people are basically really fantastic in a disaster situation. It's really beautiful to watch. There was a book written about it, and it describes it well, and it was called A Paradise Built in Hell, because you just see the best of humanity all day long. It's just incredible to see the stuff that was pouring in. So my story starts, basically, I was in my dental office in Towson, and one of my staff members comes in and says, there's been an earthquake in Haiti, and it's really bad. There's nothing on the news or anything else at this point. All the cell phone towers, everything's down. And I figure I'll get home and watch it on CNN, see what's going on. Before I can do that, Dr. Mark Pinard, who works with us in the Batays, he's kind of our Mother Teresa in the area. He directs us to any one of the 200 Batays that need help. And he's calling us on the phone. He's an American surgeon, Haitian by birth. And he calls us and says, when are we going to get there? Not if we're going to get there, it's when are we going to get there? I'm like, well, we're like still waiting for it to come on to CNN, right? And so about 12 hours later, we find ourselves on somebody's private jet plane. And we've got Dale and Dorothy, who are the founders of the organization, the NGO that we work for and have been there for a couple of years. We've got Renee, who's a combat medic with 4 or 5 tours in Iraq, and the rest of the plane is stuffed with medical supplies. And we're on this private jet, sort of like the Beverly Hillbillies going, we're on a private jet. And this is kind of the last time I was comfortable for the week. So anyways, we land, we try to fly into Port-au-Prince, where we're going to see if we can find Nadia and bring her out to someplace safer to have her baby. As it turns out, Port-au-Prince is not a good place to land at this time. There's no tower, there's no nothing. So we land in the Dominican Republic. We make our way up to the border where Dr. Pinard is there. And we stop at the first hospital on the other side of the Dominican-Haitian border. And our combat medic takes one look at this place. And it's sort of Dante's Inferno. You don't want to describe it to civilians. It's just too horrible. And he says, this place is not salvageable. There's nothing we can do here. It's too out of control. It's beyond hope. Just then, Dr. Mark comes and finds us, and he says, "I've commandeered a compound. It's got a walled compound. It's a five-acre compound with two-story buildings, and that's where we'll set up and get started. So we go out to the compound, and we decide that one building is going to be our surgical suites, to call them that, would be a sort of a loose definition, and on top of that would be where people would crash. We'd also cook up there, and we'd have meetings up there. That was what we loosely called our hospital administration space. And the other building was supposed to be an orphanage. It wasn't finished yet, and that was going to be our post-op care area, where after people had their surgeries, we'd take them there. It was also our triage area. And so people kind of trickle in at first, and then we find out that they're actually making people leave Port-au-Prince, and they're not giving any medical care out there, so they're sending them outside of Port-au-Prince. We're the first place they run into, so a trickle of patients critically injured, it turns into kind of a tidal wave, and volunteers come in from all over the world, all speaking different languages, and I was glad I had my clipboard on me, because when you have your clipboard, it gives you a certain... People assume that if you have a clipboard, you must have answers inside that. The only thing more powerful is a walkie-talkie to give you a gravitas and authority. So people are coming up to me, and because I was one of the first people there, I did have a couple of answers, like where the bathrooms and stuff were, and they weren't working, but anyway, because the buildings weren't finished yet. So they'd come up and they'd ask me, they're having a problem with this or that, and I would ask them, well, what do you think the solution is? And they would tell me, and I would say, okay, so there's a problem with the water and the plumbing, so you're now the facilities manager, okay? Because you've told me what the problem is, you must know what the solution is. So on they went to do their thing, and then various other people would come up to me, and we'd start the Department of Surgical Sterilization Instruments, and the Department of the Press became a problem after a while. So someone would come up and say, hey, we're having a problem with the press. I'd say, you're the press secretary. You're elected. I've got the clipboard, so I've got that kind of power. So anyways, it's hard to describe this compound. There are hundreds of wounded. You see? It shouldn't have happened this early. It happens later in the story, okay? I would make it a point to go to the farthest point in the camp, which was down where the patients were recovering from their surgeries. And I would sit down in the same room and find out how people were doing, because I was sort of out of touch up in the other building, up in hospital administration. And I would sit down with them, and there'd always be problems. Water, sewage, not enough translators, no pain pills, always problems. And the patient always told me that they weren't getting enough to eat. And I thought, now the doctors told me we had X number of patients. I'm pretty sure we're getting enough food out to all these patients. Well, I don't know where or when it finally dawned on me or why it dawned on me, but we weren't just feeding the patients. The patients were sharing their food with the caregivers, right? So we're giving them like a third of the calories, maybe a quarter of the calories that they need. So we go to work providing more food and whatnot, and I drop down to the same room every night in the post-op center to see how things are going. They said, well, we're getting more food, but still not enough. Finally, we decided it'd be a good idea to let the Haitians cook the food that we were cooking, because they would make better food that Haitians liked. That turned out to be a good idea. So I got out to the room the next day. How are we doing? Well, we're getting more food, but still not enough. I said, well, I tell you what. I can't come back down here tonight to find out whether you got enough food. So every night they would sing a hymn, and it would loft over the camp, and the Haitians are very religious, and everyone would stop, they'd take a breath, and it just amidst all this misery, there was just this beautiful thing going on, right? And so so anyway, we all decide we're going to sing, they'll sing Amazing Grace, right? So I go back up to the meeting up in the hospital administration center in the other building about 100 yards away. And if they get enough to eat, they're going to sing Amazing Grace. Well, I'm in the middle of our meeting, and the people who are coming now actually knew what they were doing, right? These were actual first responders. We were just people there. And it was decided we needed an organizational chart. And there was Dr. Mark Pinard, the sort of founder of the organization and the guy who knew things on the ground. And then... Is that my bell or is that your phone? So anyway, they're deciding they need an organizational chart, right? So there's Dr. Mark Bernard, a couple people below him, and then there's me, chief of staff. I'd never been chief of staff of anything. I'm a dentist, right? I would never tell people I was a dentist because my clipboard gravitas would disappear when they found that out. So anyway, they we're in this meeting, and I'm pretty proud of myself, but didn't last long because here's the part where I cry. They start singing Amazing Grace, and I'm glad I have my clipboard because I'm just hiding behind my clipboard, and I'm having my moment. Everyone seemed to have their moment in disasters like this because you see so many things that you wish you could unsee, and every once in a while you just had to, like, duck into a room and cry, and then you'd come back out and go back to work. And so jumping ahead a few days, I'm talking to this bus full of Japanese people and trying to figure out who they are, what they are, what do they have for us, do they have any money? We're all short of cash in the field. The translation is going from Japanese to German to Spanish to English and back and forth like this. And I feel it. Here's the part I promise. I feel a tap on my shoulder, and there's Nadia. She's alive. She's well. She's pregnant as can be. So we're just crying with each other. We're just so glad to see one another. We're hugging and crying. I cry every time I tell the story. That's why they hired me to do this gig. I always wonder what the people on the bus in the Japanese people thought. Here's the guy who's supposed to be in charge with the clipboard. He's crying furiously with his translator. And anyway, so to jump to the end of our story, we get Nadia a medical visa to come to the United States to have her birthright citizenship anchor baby in the United States. Yeah. Long story. It's too long to tell. Anyway, so she's back in Baltimore. She has her baby. Takes like three surgeons to deliver this baby. The tumor turns out to be benign, right, which is good news. But this is 2010 January in Baltimore. Anyone remember what happened in 2010 January? Snowmageddon. Huh? Snowmageddon. A disaster, right? Well, Nadia's looking at this whole thing and thinking, why is this a disaster? So if this happened in Haiti, you had 2 feet of fresh water fall from the sky. It's free, and it's already chilled. They would call this a miracle. End of my story. Thank you.